meeting of the Safety and Security Committee, and let me turn it over first to Jim Doherty for our safety contact.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Downing, members of the board. Just in the event of an emergency, we'd ask that you exit the building, my right or left for the exit, cross Fifth Street using a crosswalk, and we would assemble on the sidewalk in front of the building museum as the lawn area is obstructed with the restaurant services. Our safety contact for this morning deals with summer safety, and basically, you know, with a header of fun in the sun, everyone enjoys a little bit of summer fun, but it's always important to monitor the weather conditions and extreme heat, especially if you plan on being outside. Here are some tips to keep in mind. No matter how long you plan on being out, wear sunscreen with an SPF of at least 15. Take water breaks every 15 minutes when working or playing outdoors. Try to set up a shady or air-conditioned recovery area if possible. Wear a hat and UV-absorbent sunglasses. Eat small, light meals before outdoor activity. And listen to your body. Even after following all the necessary precautions, you should still be on the lookout for overexertion. Overexertion accounts for about 3.3 million emergency room visits a year in the United States. And symptoms can be heightened in the heat. Stop and take a break if you experience the following: dizziness, sore or painful muscles, pulse higher than recommended exercise pulse for your size and physical condition, feeling very hot and sweating profusely, lower abdominal pain or nausea. When working in the yard, upkeep is essential during the warmer months, but it is also a common cause of injury. Lawnmowers alone send tens of thousands of people to the emergency room each year. Don't start mowing until you know how to operate the equipment and follow safety instructions. Fill up the gas tank when the engine is cold, never hot. Clear the area from rocks and sticks to prevent flying debris. Wear eye and ear protection and appropriate shoes and clothing when operating a lawnmower working nearby. And keep children and pets away from the area. And just as a little tidbit of information, lawnmower blades can move up to speeds of 200 miles per hour. That would conclude our safety contact for this morning, Chairman Downey. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Doherty. Can I have a motion to approve the agenda for this morning's meeting? And a second. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
And we have the minutes from our meeting of May 22nd. A motion to approve? And second. Any comments, changes to the minutes? Hearing none, the minutes are approved. Before we get started, I've got some good news, I think some excellent news, with respect to the National Transportation Safety Board. We have been tracking and working through with them on a number of recommendations, and in the last couple of days, two letters have come closing three pending recommendations, which I think is terrific. Number one, they had recommended that we institute a non-punitive safety reporting program. That has been done. It's the first in the transit industry, and they have closed their recommendation on that basis. Second is with respect to the automatic train control system, which we were briefed on a couple of months ago. That had two recommendations, one of which was that we do a comprehensive analysis, which was briefed to us recently. That comprehensive analysis was provided to the safety board, and they say they've reviewed it, and that study satisfies their requirements. The other was that based on the findings of the safety analysis, we should take whatever steps are needed. They report that they have looked at what we're doing, and let me just quote, because you have incorporated the design, operational, and maintenance controls necessary to address potential failures in the ATC system, that second recommendation is also closed acceptable. Those are two big milestones. We still have three or four safety board items that are outstanding, five outstanding. I'll go over the math with you again. Oh, I see. Yes, five outstanding, most of which are real long-term. They're not going to give us credit for replacing the 1,000 series cars until they can see that they've been replaced. But the fact that we've continued to make progress, I think, is very important. And at the board meeting, the CEO will also talk about a safety award that was that we received at the APTA Rail Conference, and some kind words that came from one of our former interlocutors on safety issues, but that also was good news. So let's move on to the meeting. As an information item, shortly, Chief Safety Officer Jim Doherty will brief us on the quarterly safety report with its trends and results. But first, we do have, and this is rare for this committee, but we do have an action item, which is brought to us this month. In context, we will not take it to the board today. In the usual fashion, it will come to the board at its next meeting, so there's time to look at it. But it's an important issue. As you know, we have an extensive camera network that we use. It's a critical element in our safety and security work. And we recognize the need, and in fact, the federal requirement, that the regional law enforcement network have access to these camera images. But that requires some thoughtful steps to be sure that we have policies in place that properly would create the proper climate for that sharing of information, and that ultimately the staff will adopt specific policies to assure that our broad view is met. We're going to hear from the chief about this. He's also pointed out in a memo that there are issues where the interpretation of the policy, the guidance that we can offer as to what we expect, will help in developing those procedures. So we'll go through it today, and at the July board meeting, it can come back either to us or directly to the board as needed. Let me turn it over to Chief Pavlik.
Thank you, and good morning, Chairman Downey and members of the board. Today, the MTPD is seeking board approval to establish a principle-based policy on camera sharing. In FY09, WMATA was awarded a grant through the Council of Governments to install street-level entrance-exit cameras at all of our Metro Rail stations. The funds were subsequently awarded through the Urban Area Security Initiative, also known as UASI, costing nearly $3 million. A requirement of the grant was WMATA had to share the camera feeds with the regional law enforcement and first responders. The only cameras that had to be shared were the cameras installed through the UASI grant. To date, there are no formal ongoing video sharing arrangements with our regional partners. However, we have shared video feeds previously. It is on a very limited basis and for specific planned events. For example, the United States Marine Corps Marathon last year. We know providing that the street level entrance exit camera feeds to first responders provides real-time information to confirm or discredit a call for service. And I'll give you an example. A call is received at the local 911 center for smoke observed at the Judiciary Square station, and a large group of customers were seen self-evacuating. Multiple calls are coming in, overwhelming the jurisdictional call center and providing various pieces of additional information. The situation is very chaotic. WMATA is contacted and requested to stop all train movement until first responders are on the scene. Until first responders arrive, there is no way to validate the gravity of this incident or even confirm, in fact, there is an actual incident going on. Camera feeds at the street level entrance exit provide real-time information so the right decisions can be made early into an incident. I know from personal experience, having as much information as soon as possible is critical to scene management and decision making. The street level entrance exit cameras installed through the UASI grant are separate and distinct from WMATA's existing camera network. As a matter of information, the number of cameras per station varies depending on the size of the station, the number of levels, platform, mezzanines, etc. Currently, WMATA has 3,588 cameras in their stations. The street-level entry-exit cameras enhance the existing camera network that is already in place. For obvious security reasons, we do not provide details publicly about exact camera locations. The Metro Transit Police processed nearly 5,000 video requests last year. These requests came from internal and external stakeholders, with the top three external requests being criminal-related matters, subpoenas from the jurisdictional courts, and park requests. Cameras provide another layer of situational awareness and are able to provide real-time information to users, for example, in crowd control situations. When there is a service-related incident in the rail system, WMATA employees can call up the cameras at the incident location and observe firsthand what is transpiring. This information is then relayed to our first responders as they are en route to the incident scene. This critical information also provides WMATA managers the ability to make potential life-saving decisions on chain movements, where to deploy our resources, and the ability to assess how the incident is impacting other areas of the rail system. All of this information is available real-time, but is only available to select WMATA users. In addition to crowd control, I believe our camera system provides essential security and comfort to our riders and our customers. In order for law enforcement to be successful at protecting citizens, it is vital that the law enforcement professionals take a multi-layer approach, and our camera system is just one of the many layers that we use to deter and prevent criminal activity. Also, many cases, both internal and external, have been successfully resolved because of video availability. We know police officers cannot be everywhere, and just like the real-time intelligence that the cameras provide for crowd control purposes or incident management, the same principles apply to security. Numerous agencies across the National Capital Region are currently participating in the MVU project through the Maryland Coordination Analysis Center. Some of those agencies include the Maryland Transportation Authority, the Maryland Department of Transportation, the Prince George's County and Montgomery County Police, Fire, and EMS, the District of Columbia Police, Fire, and EMS, Fairfax County Office of Emergency Management, Fairfax Fire EMS, Arlington County Police, Fire, and EMS, and the Virginia Department of Emergency Management. The internal WMATA policy will be formulated around these five basic principles. WMATA will remain the exclusive owner of all videos, and any videos that are released will be approved by WMATA prior to being released. WMATA will approve which public safety and transportation agency have access to our street-level entrance-exit cameras. WMATA will maintain control of all cameras at all times. Several of our cameras have a PTZ filter feature, which stands for pan, tilt, and zoom, but WMATA will maintain control of that ability. WMATA will only provide recorded video upon written request, and users that are granted access to the street-level entrance-exit cameras will not have the ability to record or archive video. WMATA will limit access to the street-level entrance-exit cameras based on the need and the proper documentation. The internal WMATA policy will establish clear outline of the entire WMATA camera system. These eight items are subsets of the previous five basic principles I previously discussed. The policy will dictate the day-to-day operations of the camera system, for example, taking into consideration future camera placement to the processing of video requests. The internal policy will be based on best practices and include an analysis of what our peers are doing in the transit industry. MVU is the portal in which WMATA will share the street-level entrance-exit cameras with regional partners that were provided through the UASI grant. The ability to record or archive data will only rest with WMATA. No other agency will be granted the ability to record or archive video images. The street-level exit cameras access will only be granted to external public safety and transportation agencies on a need basis, as is determined by the Chief of Police in concert with our General Manager and CEO. The way the process will work, the Maryland Coordination Analysis Center, MCAC, will receive a written request to view WMATA feeds. Those written requests will then be forwarded to WMATA for consideration and approval. Prior to authorizing access to any camera feed, it is important to note that WMATA will have the ability to validate what agency is viewing which cameras. The agencies that are granted approval will have the ability to monitor video feeds at any time, however, limited again to just the street-level entrance-exit cameras only. At any time, WMATA may retract that permission and close that video gateway. I want to emphasize that the Maryland Coordination Analysis Center is a pioneer in video sharing among regional stakeholders, and the MVU project has created an awesome opportunity for regional first responders to share video feeds and provide real-time situational information. Currently, this technology is not available on a regional sharing level. The sharing of street-level entrance-exit cameras at WMATA is a first step to improving and enhancing the region's response to a metro-related incident. As interoperability technology improves, WMATA will explore future opportunities to share additional video feeds with public safety and transportation agencies. Mr. Downey, this concludes my remarks, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Chief. And before we open it up to questions, I think the key issue here is how do we be sure that this is a useful tool in the law enforcement and emergency response area, which really deals with specific events, specific locations, specific times, and how do we have assurance that it's not being used to create, at the request of some three-letter agency, a database for facial recognition of everybody who's moving throughout the system? I wouldn't have thought that was an issue a year or two ago, but I want to be sure that it's being used for its purpose. And to the extent that that's covered in the principles or to the extent that you're prepared in the policies to give that kind of assurance, it will satisfy me. But let me turn it over to other board members for questions. Mr. Goldman.
Thank you, Mr. Downing. I think you've accurately stated what is the issue before the board this morning. There's clearly a value to having the feet available for law enforcement purposes and prevention of incidents, accidents. On the other hand, it has to be balanced against perceived concerns of constitutional search and seizure concerns and constitutional search and seizure violation of the Fourth Amendment and privacy concerns. So I think we do have a need for some kind of a policy statement here. You know, a policy statement, it may not be as elaborate as the joint development policy statement, but something that's of a couple pages that sets out what are, to sort of elaborate on what these principles are and how we plan to implement them. As I've thought about this over the last couple days, Chief, it seems to me that we have basically three types of entities out there that are going to want to receive the camera feed or access to our in-station cameras or cameras that are on the bus and other places on the system. The one that's easiest to deal with are the public safety, first responders, the local police type of operations that are out there, which in case of an emergency, in case of an incident, would have need for the video feed. A second group seems to me which raises more questions, as the chair alluded to, are sort of agencies out there that maybe have access to this material for purposes of intelligence collecting or for purposes of creating more broader databases, such as the NSA, Secret Service, FBI, which are not going to be in the position of first responders, either as police or emergency medical people. And third, as you alerted to, we seem to have a practice of making the feeds, and especially the videos, I guess, available to third parties. I guess that comes out of places like litigation or court things. So I think we have three different areas to deal with, and the policy should try to address what are the different factors that come into play in each of those. On a couple of the substantive issues that I would just want to comment on, how long the video feed, how long the videos from inside the station should be maintained. I believe, General Manager, you have suggested 30 or 45 days, and that seems to me to be a good sort of period of time to keep these things and then destroy them unless they're needed to be kept alive. And I think that's where the policy has to sort of expound and say what are those conditions or those circumstances where we would want the in-station feed to be retained for a longer period. It strikes me that some of them are easy to identify, where there's been an accident during the day, you know, where litigation has arisen or is likely to arise, a police investigation that may not have resulted in an actual charging somebody with a crime at that point, but where the police indicate that there's something that they're looking at. But I think those kind of incidents should be spelled out so that we really know under what limited circumstances we are not going to be destroying the video that's kept and go forward. I think a second issue which you've raised is that we appear to be saying to the local jurisdictions that we provide a live video feed to that we are in control of, and when we retain ownership of that image, which would suggest that we would be in our contracts stating that they cannot make a recording of what's coming across on the live feed, and they cannot transfer that to third parties. But saying that means that we need to have some sanction if they do. Obviously, it doesn't help if we just have a policy, but we don't have a sanction if local jurisdictions violate it. The other part of that issue is that, and I guess it's maybe that, as the chair indicated, what we thought might be possible 2 years ago, we don't think the same thing can be prevented today. You know, so anybody, police officer, can stand in front of that video feed and start recording something live on his cell phone or on a camera, a video camera, or something like that. And, you know, I think we're saying you can't do that, but if they do that, we should be able to tell them in advance that's the kind of violation that we may take some sanction against. you know, shifting to the federal agencies, I guess my concern there is, as the chair indicated, I'm sure we don't want our live feed or to be used to essentially create a continuous database over a long period of time of what riders in the system are doing. How we protect against that is something that we should try to address in the policy statement. But I think this is more difficult because I suspect the NSA and other federal agencies have technology that even though we tell them they can't record a live feed, they will find a way, whether legally or illegally, to make a recording of that live feed. And I think we have to try to address in our policy statement what we do when we discover that kind of action happening. You know, on our third group, I think the third parties, I guess my view of that is that's absolutely right. We should be able to provide a video in case of litigation. But we should be able to identify what are the entities that would be getting that. I assume it would include not just police and by court order, but defense lawyers as well should be able to gain access to them. We should have some standards so that we can't be accused of acting in an arbitrary manner in how we decide who should be able to get that. It struck me as well that there may be a third category of people who are legitimate academic researchers who maybe would come across and would want to see how the system is functioning or you know, say that they'd like to look into how WMATA is using and how other jurisdictions are using the camera. And so that may be a legitimate, that may be an illegitimate use of our system, but we should be able to figure out some way to address that in some way in our policy statement. So those are my initial thoughts. I hope you with the GM can come back with something that's more sort of developed over the next couple of weeks that we can talk about and address and approve in July. Thank you.
I also would ask, question was raised about constitutional issues. I would ask General Counsel if she could give us some information about what those issues are with respect to images they come up to.
Good morning. Good morning, committee members and Mr. Downey. I'm happy to speak to the constitutionality issues that were raised by Mr. Goldman, and I provided to you a memo that is the subject line is Fourth Amendment and Privacy Implications of Camera Sharing, which sets forth my opinion, which is that there are no that I don't believe a viable claim can be stated based on invasion of privacy or violation of the Fourth Amendment based on installation of cameras in public places in our metro rail or bus system or based on WMATA sharing of video images captured by these cameras with our jurisdictions. I have reviewed the case law, and I believe the case law is well settled. There is a U.S. Supreme Court case, Kylo versus United States in 2001, that held that a Fourth Amendment search occurs when the government violates a subjective expectation of privacy that society recognizes as reasonable. The case law is fully developed across the country and including in the our particular jurisdictions that video surveillance does not in itself violate a reasonable expectation of privacy. Videotaping of persons in public places such as banks does not violate the Fourth Amendment, and that the police may record what they normally may view with the naked eye. Other cases speak more specifically to the invasion of privacy analysis, and the analysis under that common law tort is equally clear. The general principle is that images that are captured in a public place, by definition, do not invade a privacy right because there is no reasonable expectation of privacy that attends to a public forum.
I like the case where the woman lifted her shirt and then said, you've invaded my privacy by videotaping it.
Yes.
Yeah. Where was that?
I hesitated to put it in the memo.
Yeah. One other issue in terms of uses of the day, of the images, certainly were there to be a serious event, a bombing or else, something like that, clearly we would retain the images for the investigative purposes. We know from Boston, as we know from London, those are critical tools in tracking down the perpetrators and attributing and perhaps punishing those people. Other questions?
Thank you,
Mr. Now, after we go around, I will ask for any response from the chief. Yes.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Chief, you mentioned we got a lot of money for UASI. I forget what UASI stands for anymore, but is that Homeland Security? Was it grant?
It's the grant under the Department of Homeland Security, but it's the Urban Area Security Initiative.
Urban Area. All right. So in the grant or the Homeland Security, do they have any principles that we're should be aware of, or are they contrary to what we're trying to do here today, or
no,
how do they handle this?
No, really the only requirement through UASI, because the Council of Governments was the holder of the grant, they always make it a regional matter. So when we applied for the grant in FY09, we had to sell it as how is this helping the entire region. And then UASI, the only stipulation they had was that we share it with the region. But they don't have any principles as far as the how, other than share it.
And reciprocally, we can assume access their images.
Yes, so if and when we were doing the MVU project, we would have access to all of MTA. Anybody who's a principal player in the group, we would have access to all their camera feeds as well. I will double check, but not that I'm aware of, sir.
I wanted to follow up on your analogy you used, because in the memo and the description we said we have a limited time that we keep these. And so in the other incidents in which we would say an event occurred that was significant and you wanted to have something, is there some criteria that you use to make those determinations? You used a very explicit one, but how might it vary in terms of
right. So I have a chief counsel that supports the Metro Transit Police Department, Janice Cole. And Ms. Cole works closely with the chief, and when we have either an incident or an investigation or a claim or a potential claim, we put what is known as a litigation hold on documents, images, video, all materials related to that that might be necessary to aid in the investigation or support our litigation efforts.
But I think it would be in our protection to have stated policies so that when someone comes and asks for it and we say, that's going to the memory hole, no one can say that was a cover-up. That was just routine.
Right. Certainly routine formalizing process. This in our document retention policy, a video retention as part of our document retention, our overall retention policy would be easy to do and certainly appropriate.
Mary, and then Tom.
Thanks. So, Chief, what you said today actually was a nice expansion, I think, on what we got in the memo. And one of my concerns is that we get to the right level of policy for the board, so you have room to move, but we're all clear kind of what the rules of the road are. The other thing, so I think the conversation's been helpful, and I'm sure you'll come back with something. The other thing I would say that I think is missing from the resolution that was given to us with the package is sort of a broader statement about why we have cameras. We don't have cameras for the heck of it. We have them for a particular purpose. And I think for the board to start out and clearly state, this is why we have cameras in our system, the safety, the security, the ability to collaborate with partners, regional partners on those issues, also sets us in a different context. It's not just that we have cameras, we have them for a reason. And I think that protects us, too, from other people wanting our images because it says they're only for these reasons. And so I would really encourage you as we refine this and head toward next month that we clarify that, too, because I think it sets the stage a lot more clearly for the public.
I think it's important to recognize that we've talked about several issues. I don't think there is a question about the Fourth Amendment and the public marketplace, public space. So setting that issue aside, the other is a focus that we have about sharing information with law enforcement and the parameters for that. And I think that's a defensible framework that is more easily codified and formalized. The element that I think is missing is what our customers have as an expectation about the use of their image as they use the system. This needs, I think, a framework that makes explicit and implicit that we value our customers, we value their concerns about the use of their image, and that we have these safeguards in place to be able to assure them that in entering the system, you're not entering a surveillance environment that gives them any sense of unease. I don't see that up front in this as a focus on the perceptions of the users of our system around this issue. I'm strongly advocating that we articulate that in a better fashion than simply the information sharing among law enforcement agencies. The area is changing rapidly as the Supreme Court's recent decision about cell phones and privacy and get a warrant, as the Chief Justice said. So I think it's important for the authority to clearly state the framework about guarding the image of our users and putting this in the context primarily of meeting their expectations of our stewardship of their use of the system.
And I don't think we need to have them sign a waiver to come on board.
None of that.
But, yeah, the fundamental, I think the message is if you behave, we'll behave.
Well, it's also that their image
won't be used for,
won't be hanging around for 100 years,
right.
That it won't be used for other purposes, right. And that we respect their use of the system to the extent that we can in this environment.
Yeah, I would just echo that, and also I'm just sitting here thinking about the fact that we also need to emphasize that we are very sensitive to that. That's why we're adopting these principles. That's why we have these rules, so at least when you enter this system, you know what the rules are, especially when you put it in the context of the, a lot of other places that you go that you may be recorded, and you have there are no rules or guidelines or anything, and that we are being as sensitive as we can to make sure that our customers are protected and that these are reasonable rules. So I just want to make sure we keep the context here, because when you're walking in a mall or some other places, you could be recorded and you have no idea and no rules.
Your surveillance at an airport starts as much as a mile from the airport.
Yeah. It doesn't start when I leave my garage.
Don't do anything you won't mind seeing on the Washington Post next day.
Well, I fully subscribe to what Mr. Downs has said, that we need to have something to our customers and our riders to assure them that their images are not being used and stored. But I think that requires us to be proactive in the sense of doing things to make sure that that doesn't happen. And I guess what I'm concerned about is we should be taking some steps with our IT contractors to make sure we're not getting hacked, to make sure that our security parameters are, you know, are such that they're not capable of being compromised very easily, and that we have to take some steps proactively when we find out that they are. Because I suspect in this coming age, It'll be very easy for government agencies as well as third parties to access into, not just if you can hack into federal government agencies, as some foreign parties do, and if you can hack into foreign governments and into major U.S. corporations. I suspect someone will find a way, if they want to hack into the WMATA system. You know, we need to do some things to make sure that these images are not hacked into by some other party, and where they can make a kind of library, video library, of what happens over a period of time to our system and protect our riders and what their expectations are. That as long as they behave, we're not going to allow anything to be done with their image, that they wouldn't expect that their privacy will be preserved.
Thank you. Other questions, comments from the committee members? I think this has been a very useful discussion. I think it really got to the heart of guidance that we felt, that you felt you needed. Are there questions you might have in terms of any of the specific things were raised?
No, I'm good, sir. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah.
I'd just like to respond. It was very helpful having this conversation, and I think we can return to the board in advance of the next board meeting with incorporating these.
And some may be in the resolution. I think the descriptive memo that comes with it definitely should get some of these points about why we do this and what our customers gain from it and what the contract in effect with them as to how it would be used. Mm-hmm. An important thing to have on the record.
Mr. Downey, I would just encourage that we include as much of the principal kind of stuff as possible in the resolution, because the resolution stands for the board's take on this and our direction to the manager.
Yeah. And I think that's good, and that's what we're looking for. Just in response to a couple comments, sanctions, what I view sanctions as is if we find a user violating the terms of the agreement, they're not allowed to use the system anymore, either for a period of time or forever, depending on how egregious their violation. So I think that's where we're headed on that. There are times when the federal agencies should have viewing rights, in my view, the FBI, the Secret Service, and that usually revolves around specific planned events where there may be terrorist concerns and that type of thing. You know, we should make it available to the, but not on a continuous basis. So, thank you.
One thing that I would worry about, and I don't know how to deal with it, should we get a national security letter, which frankly says you must turn over the following because we're interested in it, and you may not tell anybody you have done that. I don't know what the response is, but you might want to think about that. If you say no, we'll send you a cake. Okay. Anything else on security? No, I think it's been a good discussion. Mr. Doherty?
Thank you, and good morning again, Chairman Downey, members of the board. This morning I will brief the committee on the quarterly safety progress and provide an update along with...
Let me say this was an action item. What I'd suggest is we not take action today. We will be prepared, if we're comfortable, to take action at the next safety committee and take it to the board the same day, if that works.
I can provide the board with an update on where we're at with our fatigue risk management system. First slide is our employee injury rate, and for the first quarter of calendar year 2014, our employee injury rate was 4.55, which is a 10% decrease from the same time period last year, which was 5.07. The employee injury rate is also lower than the corporate target of less than 4.8 injuries per 200,000 hours worked, of course, realizing we always have our goal of zero. For benchmarking purposes against other agencies, the Bureau of Labor Statistics lists the average for transit and ground passenger transportation at 5.1 injuries per 200,000 hours worked. Nearly all of the main offices within WMATA have seen significant decreases when compared to the same period last year. Nearly all of the main injury types experienced year over year decreased, with the exception of slips, trips, and falls and collision-related injuries. The primary cause of the increase in these two groups were weather-related, specifically due to ice and snow. The first quarter of 2013 had only 8 injuries that were attributed to icy conditions, and that would be slipped on the ice, vehicle collisions where icy conditions was the key contributing factor. The first quarter of 2014 had 25 injuries that were attributed to icy conditions. As it is now June, we have completed the data set through May for employee injuries. After the weather improved in April, the rate trends down in a positive direction. In May, Wilmot experienced the lowest employee injury rate since July 2012 at 3.3. July of 2012 actually was 3.20, so actually that's a good rate for the month. The calendar rate year-to-date, January through May, as it stands now, is 4.22. Review of our customer injury rate. The first quarter of calendar year 2014, the customer injury rate was 2.12, which is a 22% increase from the same time period last year, which was 1.74. The customer injury rate is also higher than a corporate target of less than 1.8 injuries per 1 million passenger trips. All three modes experience injuries, increases in their injury counts. For rail, there were increases in onboard and station-related injuries, but a decrease was seen in escalator injuries. For bus, there were significant increases in collision-related injuries and a moderate increase in non-collision-related injuries. Metro Access had slight increases in both collision-related and non-collision-related injuries. Nearly all of the main injury types experienced year-over-year increases, with the main driver being collision-related injuries. The main factors that contributed to the increase were customer inattention and distraction, wet walking surfaces, and intoxication. Icy conditions were not a contributing factor, but wet surfaces due to snow melt and rain were outliers. As it is now June, we have completed the data set through May for customer injuries. The customer injury rate January through May is 2.0, still above the target of less than 1.8, with January and February proved to be challenging months, and March and April both have customer injury rates near 1.5.
Mr. Chairman? Yeah, thank you for the report, and I apologize. I'm just hearing the tail, no, not the tail end, but maybe the middle portion. But what's our timetable? Remind us about timetable again for replacing the towels at the old stations. I mean, I had almost a similar incident last week at Braddock Road, getting off of a inbound train walking on the platform, and it was humid, moist, 80 degrees, whatever, about 5 o'clock in the evening, and I was just walking naturally, and all of a sudden I slipped because the moisture on the platform from humidity. What's our timetable?
I'll get back to you on the specific timetable on that.
All right.
The main driver for the rate increase is bus collision events where multiple customers are transported from the scene. Approximately half of the 34 bus collisions that resulted in customer injuries resulted in more than one person being transported. Of the 57 passengers that have been transported from the scene for medical care, only 12 were from 6 preventable events. So what we're seeing is the non-preventable events and then multiple people claiming injury, for example, if a bus gets struck in the rear. And
our policy continues to be, I think, correctly, if the passenger is transported, that's what we count, if they're then discharged.
Yes, sir. That's the requirement of the FTA, National Transit Database. So, moving on to our corrective action plans, and I will note that this doesn't include the recent announcements of the NTSB closures, although those have been forwarded over to the talk. But year-to-date in our corrective action plans, and this is actually January 1st through May 23rd, 30 corrective action plans have been closed. You note in 2008, there's the 2 corrective action plans that remain open. One is from the Eisenhower-DuPont investigation, addressed the technology to alert wayside workers were approaching trains, and we're currently working to actually come up with a system to be able to respond to that. If I could just note, for 2011, there were 317 total caps. 294 have been closed, with 23 open. 2012, 92 total, 85 closed, 7 open. And 2013, 68 total caps, 23 closed, and 45 open. So there's been a major, major stride in closing the corrective action plans, as well as to identify areas for improvements. This slide provides you the update following our hazard analyses of the various corrective action plans that we have.
And at least one of the ones that was closed today falls in the red, maybe two.
Yes, actually, the NTSB 10-42, conduct the safety analysis, is one of the reds that was rated at a 1B. And actually, based on the findings, was a 1C, so the reds will go away for our next report. So certainly great news.
Thank you. Now, fatigue management.
Fatigue management, yes. There's been a lot of progress as we move forward, as you know. We're basically in a voluntary fashion without regulation over public transit with our fatigue risk management system. And I would like to introduce Dr. Francine James, who's a consultant that's been working with us and a scientist as we've been building our system based on science and data, as we like to do, and also to make sure that we can achieve the greatest degree of safety. Dr. James.
Thank you, Mr. Doherty. Good morning, Mr. Downey, and to the members of the board. The FRMS, the Fatigue Risk Management System, is an approach that encompasses the development of multiple programs, each individually and collectively intended to reduce the risk of fatigue and fatigue-related incidents throughout the authority. So as Mr. Doherty was saying, with the development of its Fatigue Risk Management Program, WMATA is taking a comprehensive and, importantly, a science-based approach to reducing the risk of fatigue and fatigue-related incidents throughout the organization. So establishing hours of service rules or limits on the length of the duty period. You can go to the next slide. Thanks. Providing limits on the length of duty periods are an important part of limiting the accumulation of fatigue-related risk, and they also allow sufficient time for recovery off-duty. The hours of service rules that are going to come under this FRMS were developed via a really thorough process that integrated scientific results, best operational practices, and importantly, biomathematical models of fatigue that quantify the risk associated with actual and planned schedules. The first hours of service rules to go into effect will cover personnel in bus and rail transportation as well as personnel in rail car maintenance. The rules will limit the duty tour to no longer than 14 hours. This includes the period of interim release, and they limit the total duty time within the duty tour to no longer than 10 hours. Importantly, the rules also make allowances for time off so that personnel can get the rest required to be safe in their performance the next day. So under the rules to be written into effect, personnel will have a minimum of 10 consecutive hours off after each shift, and there'll be a limit of 6 consecutive shifts before time off is mandated. The next phase of the hours of service rules development will include rules for non-transportation, Metro PD, and for Metro Access. The analyses required for the development of those rules are currently ongoing. For transportation, the rules will be signed into effect imminently in the next couple of days, where full compliance is anticipated by the end of the year. Ongoing review by the steering committees will be in place to evaluate not just compliance to the hours of service rules, but also to determine where additional mitigations might be necessary. And one of the tools that we're going to use to be able to establish our success with fatigue risk management in terms of the duty limits will be the fatigue risk management dashboard. The dashboard is analogous to other automated reporting systems that are currently in use by safety, and it's designed as a web-based application that will use actual work schedule data to calculate fatigue metrics throughout the organization. And so by combining actual work schedule data with organizational data, we'll be able to devise metrics that report on compliance with various aspects of the hours of service rules by division. And additionally, I should say importantly also, because we know that all legal schedules are not necessarily the safest schedules, the dashboard will also run analyses using biomathematical models of fatigue on the actual schedule. So we'll be able to look at hours of service compliance and, in addition, any residual fatigue-related risks so that they can be mitigated in a, we'd like to say, a surgical way. The first rollout of the dashboard will report on personnel and transportation, and we'll have a soft start at the end of the summer. Understanding the contribution of fatigue to recorded incidents is an important aspect of being able to develop mitigations to the risk that we identify. So the goal of this FRMS program is to provide investigators with the tools and the knowledge that they would need to capture the role of fatigue in incidents, not unlike the approach that the NTSB uses in their investigations. Our revisions to the process were developed by a working group including subject matter experts, management, SAFE, and investigators. Under this program, investigators will receive data collection tools that will enable them to capture fatigue-related information. They'll also receive access to biomathematical modeling tools that will enable them to analyze the fatigue risk associated with personnel schedules involved in the incident under investigation. And finally, they'll get the training, education, and support required to be able to collect good data and make recommendations that can be used to mitigate risk, not only in the department that experienced the incident, but also through the steering committees of the FRMS to see which mitigations can have application authority-wide. These new tools are going to be rolled out and piloted this summer, and a final version of the procedures and documents will be go into effect by the end of the calendar year. The Quiet Room and Recuperative Breaks program is based on data that achieving additional sleep, such as with naps, is an effective countermeasure to fatigue-related risk. So in this initiative, personnel will have access to quiet rooms for use during their off-duty hours. Either this is unpaid time, such that existing rules prohibiting sleep on duty would not be contradicted by the use of the quiet rooms. The program and the room were designed based on best practices and done in consultation with the FRMS Steering Committee as well as management. Pending the notice to proceed, the quiet rooms will become available at Landover and Shepherd's Parkway, which importantly makes them accessible to safety-critical personnel. We'll be collecting feedback on the rooms, the initiative, and the pilot, and during the initiative, during a pilot run, so that we can make appropriate changes based on feedback from personnel and continuously improve both the program and the rooms to which they have access. We skipped one, but I can tell you about the second, thank you, the secondary employment program. The secondary employment policy and approach within the FRMS is distinct from existing secondary employment conflict of interest policies. What we're looking for in fatigue risk management is how scheduled activities outside of work can interfere with one's ability to get the rest required to perform safely at work. So the first planned step in this initiative is an educational component with a declaration of awareness. And the declaration of awareness is essentially declaring that one understands the importance of securing appropriate time for rest to be safe at work the next day. This rule would not supersede existing more strict conflict of interest rules that are already in effect throughout the authority. The next steps to this policy could be, and they would be determined by the FRMS steering committees, and could involve data collection on the occurrence of scheduled non-work activities or guidance on the approval of secondary employment based on fatigue risk management strategies. And finally, the awareness and education-related aspects of the FRMS affects all of the individual initiatives. The awareness campaigns are designed to promote the individual initiatives, just as they're important to provide fatigue risk management education. And this takes place in print, electronic, in-person meetings. We use all aspects of outreach to the organization to be able to spread the word about initiatives and fatigue risk management countermeasures. There's also a more formal education and training program that has been developed and will be rolled out imminently. Currently, there's a computer-based training program that's been supported by the medical department that's been revised, and we anticipate running a pilot by the end of the year. And that concludes my remarks.
Thank you. Questions, Mr. Blatter?
Excellent report. I just wanted to ask a couple questions about the steering committee. and you mentioned who's on the steering committee. Does the steering committee get at the question of long commutes for our workers? Did that get addressed?
It hasn't been a direct focus, and so the steering committees for the moment have been focused on developing the initiatives. We have an operational steering committee that provides sort of operational experience, whereas the executive steering committee can enable us to make our recommendations and bring them into effect. We haven't directly addressed the commute. However, we would like to address the commute in a data collection so that we can know how long individual commutes are and then be able to create directed mitigation. So that's not currently a directed initiative.
Could you add that? Because every time I ask a Metro worker where they happen to live, they live really pretty far away from where they work. I mean, there's rarely do I get, oh, I live around the corner or up the street. It's long, long commutes. Southern Maryland, mostly? Yeah, Southern Maryland, Rich.
Duly noted. And one of the things that we're hoping to be able to do with the quiet room, we were just able to confirm that the quiet room would additionally be accessible to individuals during their interim break, so that individuals who have a long break in the middle of the day instead of commuting home could indeed use that time in the quiet room to obtain additional rest. And that would be a really, really effective fatigue countermeasure. But duly noted, we want to look and see at what kind of data we have on the commute and how we might be able to address that in our initiatives.
Because we know that the combination of on-duty and off-duty behavior is what totally defines fatigue. Read the safety board review of the Tracy Morgan truck crash on the Jersey Turnpike. The driver happened to be still within his hours of service, 13 hours and 32 minutes against his 14-hour limit. Well, I don't think he could have gotten where he was going in the last half hour, but he had been awake for more than 24 hours. And you know, whatever led to that behavior really is what led to the fatigue.
Just as
arguably
you say.
Caused the crash. Mr. Downs.
I appreciate the difficulty of getting to realistic limits on overtime in the contract environment that we have with our unions and the necessity of negotiating those in another round of contracts. Getting to 14, 10, 6, 14 hours on, 10 hours off, 6 days a week is 84 hours a week. And maybe it's a definition of the nature of the problem that this is progress. What I think is important is measuring on the dashboard that was mentioned, measuring performance in terms of hours worked, say safety sensitive or safety critical positions within the authority, not to set a limit, but simply to measure how we're doing about the workforce and potential fatigue environments. To have that be part of the dashboard on a regular basis, perhaps quarterly, the number of employees that are working in, say, excess of 65 hours a week, and how they are allocated between safety sensitive and safety critical positions, and have that be kind of a target, one of the targets about measurement of progress here, both from the management side about scheduling and from the ability to work with unions about accommodations, about some reasonable expectations about limits on the amount of work that could be done within a week. Most regulated transportation industries have regulatory caps. Everybody, maritime, aviation, highways, trucks, pipelines, everybody has some limits on hours of service. Our industry is an anomaly. I think simply measuring this as the JCC did over a year and a half ago to keep track of how, and their suggestion about the authority keeping track of how we're doing, not to set, again, not to set a limit on overtime, because I don't think that's reachable right now, but it does measure performance, and I'd like to strongly suggest that the benchmark overtime, quarterly perhaps, measures how well we're doing with those safety-sensitive and safety-critical positions.
Yeah. If you could get back to us on what the feasibility would be of that, I think it would be a useful measure. And I recall from our last discussion the point that it is very much management's responsibility to schedule the work mm-hmm. in such a way that the opportunity doesn't get created for the seven-day week. So,
And exactly that. Our objective here is people will not work the seventh day, so you don't get to the 84 hours.
But you'll get back to us on the feasibility of a quarterly report. Mary Cameron.
Just a quick observation and a question on slide 40. You talked about the places where you're piloting the quiet room. And I noticed there's no Virginia quiet room, which is what prompts my question. We're in the process of building a new bus garage at Cinderbed Road, which will have a lot of people coming and going. And so my question really is, do we have, within that contract of building that new facility, is it possible for us to get to a quiet room there so that when we open, we have such a facility on the Virginia side of the river?
We can certainly look into that, and it may be in the plans, because I know it was in Shepherd's. Yes, it will be included.
Cool. The way things have been going in Virginia the last few weeks, a quiet room would be a welcome addition, wouldn't it?
Mr. Dyke?
No, I'm just saying the way things have been going recently with related to the budget area, it'd be nice to have a quiet room we could go into over there, so thank you.
Maybe we need one in the building.
Any other questions on safety or fatigue? If not, I think we're prepared to adjourn the meeting and move into a board executive session.